Like so many of you, we battle depression during life's many ups and downs.
Music has always been there to help us through the tough times that we all face.
Follow us on our journey as we discuss the healing power of music.
Interview artists and bands.
Break down genres and music news.
Review artist biographies.
And much, much more.
You're listening to the When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to When Words Fail Music Speaks, where we fight depression with the power of music. I'm your handicapped host, James Cox. I have another great interview with me today. First, let me introduce him before we bring him on. My guest today is Alan Govnar. Did I say that right?
Yes.
All right, perfect. He is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, playwright, and cultural documentarian, whose work has preserved and celebrated the music, stories, and art of everyday people. He's the founder of Documentary Arts and has written over 30 books, including his newest novel, Come Right Round, a powerful and personal story set in the early 70s that explores trauma, identity, and American experience. Alan, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Just to correct you for a second, my novel is Come Round Right, and it takes its name from a Shaker song called Simple Gifts.
Okay, nice, yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you for correcting me because, you know, I never know if I get anything right, you know. I wouldn't imagine that everything else I said was 100% correct.
It is, in fact, correct.
Perfect, yeah, so.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you're familiar with a movie of mine called You Don't Need Feet to Dance.
I am not. No, sir.
Oh, you might want to check it out.
Okay.
Because many of my films have dealt with different areas of disability.
Oh, okay.
So I admire you for doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And there are lots of poignant stories there.
Yeah. Okay. I'll definitely check that out. Yeah, because I'm always interested in movies and primarily music, you know, because I'm always looking for new music. But I will check out that movie tonight after I talk to you. But I think it'll be, you know, very, very good for me to watch it too, you know. So, yeah. Awesome. I was so excited to talk to you because you are a blues guy, and I grew up in the Delta, Clarksdale, Mississippi. So we have that in common. But you live in Texas, correct?
Yes, but I'm originally from Boston. I grew up in Dorchester,
okay,
Massachusetts.
Yeah, Massachusetts.
I got into blues by listening to the few records that my father had brought home. And I grew up as a child. I remember distinctly at 4 years old hearing Dizzy Gillespie, Sarah Vaughan, Charlie Parker.
Charlie Parker, yeah. Yeah.
New Orleans R&B.
Right. Well, maybe you can settle this worldwide phenomenon that's been dark. A lot of people are arguing where the blues started. Clarksdale, you know, the Delta, or Memphis, you know. Since you are a documentarian, I figured you would have the last answer, the final answer, you know. Is that still like an ongoing battle between Memphis and Clarksdale, or is it like truly one or the other?
Well, I don't think it's, you know, for me, the blues emerged through this African diaspora as it was brought to America, sadly, through the slave trade. My work has really been to establish the primacy of Texas blues.
Right.
And I grew up in a world that was very Mississippi-centric in terms of the origins of blues. I don't know that there's a single origin of the blues. It was an outgrowth of a generation of African Americans seeking freedom emotionally, right, Physically. It was the music of hardship, but also of joy.
Oh, wow.
And so some of the earliest written references to blues are actually in Texas.
Yeah.
And Texas, for that, it has a unique place in this. And partly, I'm not from Texas.
Okay.
So when I came here, I began to realize through the music I was listening to and the research I was doing that so much about Texas blues was unknown. And that's what propelled my work. In 1984, I got a commission from the Dallas Museum of Art to do a project called Living Texas Blues. It was a small book, three short films, an anthology cassette tape. And it began a journey for me that spanned since 1984 to the present, because I'm still writing and thinking and documenting different aspects of blues, but also putting it into other kinds of creative forms. I work in musical theater. I work in film. I work in photography. And the medium for me is a consequence of my experience.
Yeah. It's pretty funny now that you mentioned Texas, because I just found your Deep Ellum Blues documentary that was recorded back in 1985, and that is about Dallas's neighborhood's music scene, right? And what I found very riveting is all the homeless people and gangsters and everybody came to Deep Ellum, and just, you know, I didn't know that was like the number one spot back then, you know.
Well, Deep Ellum was a destination for migrant African Americans fleeing the failed cotton crops of Deep East Texas. But it was a place where also Eastern European Jews who had made their way through Galveston up through Corsicana to Dallas and operated pawn shops. It was the place where blacks and whites and other people converged.
Right. Yeah.
And the music on the street had immense significance.
Yeah.
Most notably, Blind Lemon Jefferson, who was discovered on a street corner in Deep Ellum in front of Ashford's record store. It was actually on Central Avenue, which connected to Deep Ellum Street,
right,
where Blind Lemon stood and was ultimately discovered and recorded, brought to Chicago to record for Paramount Records. And he became the biggest selling blues singer of his generation.
Wow.
Deep Ellum had great significance, but not only for blues, but for the early years of Western swing.
Right.
It was a place where cultures converged, didn't always interact, but the musical influences were diverse and varied and impacted everyone that went there.
Right. Yeah. And I heard the guy said on the documentary that when the sun was coming up, they all dispersed. You know,
the idea that in the middle of the night, blacks and whites would play music together.
Yeah,
and I think that's the reality of the music. It reflects that.
Yeah,
but in the end, I mean, blues is only one part of a much more complex kind of cornucopia of American music.
Yeah.
And it's a very, well, it's based in a traditional form. It takes on the musics that are around it.
Right.
And Texas blues is distinctive in certain ways, but it's also incredibly eclectic and varied.
Mm. Yeah, because didn't blues create what we hear today, meaning did it create all these genres? Because you have, I think blues started a little bit before country. Correct me if I'm wrong, you know, but I think blues started a little bit before country, but blues was like a, country is like a, it's like a modern, it's a faster, a slightly faster tempo than blues. Am I correct on that?
Well, blues emerged in the 1890s among the first generation of African Americans born out of slavery. It was the music of freedom.
Right.
And it reflected the values of a newly freed people who perhaps for the first times in their lives had some opportunity for leisure. It was a music that was played as a dance music. It was played to express and give voice to the people it was about.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So you spent many decades documenting American music, right? From Texas blues to gospel traditions. So what first pulled you into towards music as a storyteller?
Well, for me, it goes back to the LPs that my father brought home when I was 4 years old, and we had a portable record player. One was Charlie Parker, Sarah Vaughan,
right,
Dizzy Gillespie. Another was New Orleans R&B. Another was classical. He bought a record that was one of the Verdi operas. It was a cha-cha record.
Yeah.
So I grew up with very eclectic musical tastes.
Right.
But somehow I think because it was filtered through my ears as a child, it was the deep expressiveness of the music. And while that was culturally specific, in other ways it transcended the culture I was from. It brought me to a different world. It made me want to become an explorer, to go out into the world and not only record music in the end, but to also become involved in other media.
Yeah.
So, for example, my book, Come Round Right, novel, I started it when I was 18 years old. And the title takes its name from a Shaker hymn called Simple Gifts. And within that song, there's a lyric that essentially says, turn, 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 till you come round right. You shan't be ashamed, come round right. Turn, turn, turn. And that's not exactly the lyric, but
right,
the
message is that's something like that
through music.
Right.
Through embracing the spirit of the music, of the God we feel within, we can come round right. So that regardless of the trauma you've experienced or are experiencing, there's hope.
Yes.
So within all my work is this theme and the necessity of hope, of optimism. At the end of the day, I'm a believer, but I'm also an advocate. An advocate for meaningful social change.
Exactly.
My first film was on a hunchback dwarf tattoo artist in a wheelchair. And he was somebody who was denied an education because he was considered too grotesque to go to school. His name was Leonard Stoney Sinclair. He became my first nonfiction book, Stoney Knows How, Life as a Sideshow Tattoo Artist. He became the subject of my first film. I learned how to make movies by documenting him. And his gift to me was that he, while he was a tattoo artist, he saw himself principally as an actor on the outdoor stage. My book and film are one of the only documents of this generation of people who were known as circus and sideshow freaks. But he saw himself, his identity was as an actor on the outdoor stage. And so I so much of my work has been focused on marginalized people, yeah, whether by culture or to some extent by disability. The film I was mentioning earlier, You Don't Need Feet to Dance, is about Siddiqui Kande. He's an African drummer and singer, lost the use of his legs to polio, mm-hmm, at age 14, became a street singer and entertainer, and ultimately became a National Heritage Fellow,
yeah,
and was an exemplar. But his main mission, and through my nonprofit Documentary Arts, we support that mission, is to focus on people with disabilities, but from his point of view, all abilities. And so within that film, there's a boy, Aaron Phillips, who is a young teenager with cerebral palsy. And he is someone who is one of Siddiqui's favorite students.
Yeah.
And he's someone for whom Siddiqui was kind of a hero. Hmm. And Aaron Phillips has had an amazing journey since being in this movie as a teenager. Hmm. And he had a Tumblr account, which drew the attention of the person who started Tumblr, which led to him at age 15 publishing his first book, which is called This Kid Can Fly.
Nice.
It's about his experience growing up as a kid with cerebral palsy, yeah, and how he was able to triumph in a certain way, yeah, because he was so determined and so creative. And there's a chapter in that book which is about the making of the movie and how much that meant to him, which him writing that and publishing that in a book had immense significance,
yeah,
and for me.
Right.
It meant it was really touching on a deep pulse of people, yeah, in need, but people who have this indomitable creative spirit. And as time has gone on, Aaron Phillip has become a she. She is now in a very important trans model.
Yeah.
She was the cover of Vogue magazine not so long ago.
Yeah, okay.
She is a spokesperson for people in the need for disability rights. So that theme is of the disenfranchised, the misunderstood, has been crucial to my work. In my new movie that's premiering in New York on November 14th, which is called Quiet Voices in a Noisy World, The Struggle for Change in Jasper, Texas, is about that. Because the core issue in my work is, how do we deal with trauma? Everyone has trauma in their lives, and it takes different forms and manifests itself in different ways. The question is, what do we do then? That's the theme of my novel, Come Round Right. That's, you know, I've made more than 24 movies. I've published over 40 books.
Yeah.
And if you were to look at them, the subjects may seem unrelated, but the core issue that it explores is, what do we do when we're faced with obstacles that may seem insurmountable? And right, I'm very much drawn to people who address that,
yeah,
in their own lives.
Yeah.
And those stories are critical to what I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you can tell, but I don't know if anybody can tell, but I have cerebral palsy also, you know. And I don't think a lot of people know that we're so creative. That's one of our outlets, I guess. You know what I'm saying? a lot of people just think we're disabled and that's all we can do, you know? So I like to prove people wrong by showing them, you know, what I can do instead of telling them, you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's very apparent.
Yeah.
What you're saying. It's very clear to me.
Right.
You're a deeply sensitive and creative man. And you have an important story. And I admire you for doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. But I admire you for being you. Because you're not allowing what's thrown your way to get in the way of trying to do something important. So I think that you'd enjoy my film.
Okay. I'm definitely going to watch it for sure. Yeah.
And you'd like the Stoney film.
Okay.
You know, I think a lot of your listeners might.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that if, you know, growing up in your situation, you have, you know, limited opportunities. You have to create your own opportunities.
That is true.
Because the world isn't kind. Kids are cruel. People are cruel.
Yeah.
But given that, do we dwell in that? Do we, you know, allow ourselves to sink into the swamp of anger and bitterness?
Yeah.
Or do we turn it into something that becomes an asset?
Right.
So within those stories that I'm telling you, I mean, and there's, if you look at my website and the work that I do, it's all about that. It's giving voice to the voiceless.
Yeah.
Because you have an important voice, James. Yeah. And I'm honored to be part of what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that means a lot to me. Okay, so my parents had a major role in my upbringing, you know, because they wouldn't let anybody tear me down, and they always built me up, you know. But one thing I can say is, one thing has been the constant in my life has always been music, you know. My Uncle Junior, Sam, Uncle Sam Junior, he taught me about the blues more than anything else before, and I owe him a lot of things and admiration, you know. But I don't know where I'm going with this.
I know where you're going.
It's just something, and I've had bullies in my past, but not so much so where, you know, I couldn't function anymore, you know. So, but I just want to thank you mostly for speaking out for us, you know, because I don't think very many people know that we are who we are and what we can do. I think we have more stuff to show the world than they think that we have, you know, to offer, you know. And I'm trying to do that with this podcast, you know. I'm trying to make everybody feel, I don't want anybody to feel the way I do when I'm depressed. You know, you mentioned bullies, you know. I grew up sort of depressed in my high school days, but I didn't know what that was. And then when in my 20s and early 30s, my mom recognized that I was becoming more depressed, so she took me to the doctor, and I'm clinically, you know, on depression pills. But I understand that that bullies can interfere with life, and people like, you know, disabled people, you know, has more of a story to tell other people, you know. So I just want to give you a big shout out and all the thanks in the world for speaking up for us.
Well, you know, I think you'd really enjoy Aaron's book, This Kid Can Fly.
Okay.
It's a remarkable book. It's amazing that it came to be, because this is about a boy 15 years old.
Yeah.
Who has cerebral palsy, much like you have had. And his story is inspiring.
Yeah.
But Siddiqui's inspiring because of his attitude. I mean, I want to make movies that enrich the world in which I live, despite all of its problems. And I'm driven. I'm committed to this message. And, you know, I think it's great that your podcast can exist and that you can have a voice, finally.
Finally, right? Yeah.
And do you mind me asking you, how old are you?
I am 45, 46 January.
Well, I have a 47, 48-year-old daughter. I have a 48-year-old daughter.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. And I have a son that's 35.
Oh, okay. So you've had a press part.
You know, I can only imagine, because I've immersed myself in the world of people who are disabled, that what it must be like. Because I experienced my own feelings of inner disability growing up. I was a pigeon-toed kid. And so I know what it's like to be subjected to bullies.
Yeah.
Not at the level that I'm sure you were, because you were, Siddiqui, you know, like Stoney, who was my, you know, the subject of my first film and book. I mean, Siddiqui was also, he was banished.
Yeah.
And he learned to dance on his hands. And that was the only way he could become a man.
Right.
Within the context of his own, you know, cultural constraints and norms.
Yeah.
But he's one of the most bright-spirited people I've ever met. And Aaron, in his current, her current form,
yeah,
is also amazing.
Right. Yeah.
So, because in the end, for me, I have this very pressing need that I feel that I hope to address through my work, which is to assert the equality of all people. We need a more equitable society.
Exactly. Yeah. I strongly agree with that, you know. Going back to what you said, you've been doing this for decades, right? How do you decide which musical traditions or stories deserve to be documented? Yeah. I'm sorry?
Could you repeat yourself? I'm sorry.
Oh.
It was a little glitch in the audio.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's okay. All right. as you said before, you've been doing this for years. You've been doing documentaries for years, right? So how do you decide which musical traditions or stories deserve to be documented? You know, like, is it like instinct, timing, or something more personal to you? You know,
I think what the music that I've been attracted to, like blues, mm-hmm, is the deep expressive nature of what it is. So I was drawn to cantorial singing. I was drawn to, you know, Mexican American norteño music. I was interested in music that may not have been virtuosic, that had immense meaning. One of my books is called Everyday Music. And it's, I'm interested in the ways in which music impacts people on an everyday basis.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, and I've, you know, worked in different media. So, I mean, I fluidly move between different kinds of writing. I work in musical theater. I write poetry, I've written novels, I've written plays, I've written children's books. And the subject that I'm focusing on is what determines the medium. But at the same time, I'm telling stories, mm-hmm, the stories of other people whose values I admire. And then I'm going into a deep dive into the innermost parts of me.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was researching you earlier this week, I found out that you organized large-scale public music events like the Dallas Fork Festival. Back in 83, correct?
I organized public free folk festivals.
Right.
My mission was to bring different people together. My organization, Documentary Arts, has been committed to that very important principle.
Yeah.
And I grew up in an immigrant world. I grew up in inner city Dorchester, Massachusetts, where there was a mix of Ukrainians and Russians and Poles and Czechs and others.
Yeah.
But it was also a world of great tension. There were different gangs. There was violence. There was racial violence. There were blacks moving up from the American South into that area. So I became very interested in seeing what I could do to try to bring people closer together.
Right.
In part, that was inspired by the work my father did.
Okay.
He worked a lot in interfaith committees. He was very much committed to bringing people of different religions together, but also people of different cultures. So I was fortunate. I was blessed that I grew up in a home where my father and mother had progressive social values.
Right. Well, this next question is going to be primarily for me, but also for my for the listeners who also want to put on some festivals like you did. So I am trying to branch out. Well, I'm going to make this an actual business. I'm going to apply for my license probably this Thursday, trying to make it a legit business, you know. But the goal for me is to do what you did, put on a festival so everybody can come together, you know, enjoy their life and experience and listen to good, clean music, you know. How did you manage to get started at that rate? And how did you pick your artists from different religions and genres and everything, you know, to bring everybody together?
I grew up in a world where there was public funding that supported this kind of activity. And sadly, in today's world, it's become much more difficult.
Yeah, it has.
To be able to do that.
Yeah.
You're in Chicago?
I am in South Carolina.
Where are you?
South Carolina.
Oh, you're in South Carolina. I thought you were in Chicago.
No,
we're in South Carolina.
Yeah. Oh, I'm in Lexington, about 20-30 minutes from the capital, Columbia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I think the best approach to try to do this kind of work is to work on a local level.
Yes.
Community groups and others.
Right.
Because this new movie of mine, which is premiering in New York at Cinema Village on November 14th, Quiet Voices in a Noisy World, is about people in Jasper, Texas, who are overcoming the intense trauma of the lynching of James Byrd in 1998. Mm. It's a community trying to heal. But they're taking it upon themselves. The movie's about the power that local people have over their own destiny.
Right.
And I think for you, being where you are, you need to reach out to local people who are simpatico with you. I mean, I've never been a full-time paid executive director of the nonprofit I founded in 1985.
Yeah.
But I've developed this network of like-minded people. So it's really reaching into your world and finding people who are willing to put the mission ahead of sometimes the revenues it might produce.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think that's where it has to start.
Yeah, because I guess it would be very foolish, I guess, of me to go guns blazing and go 100% on something I don't realize yet, you know. But I think you're right. I think local is the number one thing to do with anything, you know, nowadays, you know, because nowadays it's kind of harder to do anything now than the 80s and 90s or like early 2000s, you know.
Yeah.
So cool.
Well, I think you have that potential.
Yeah.
I can tell you're a self-starter.
Yeah, I am.
And,
yeah.
You know, I so appreciate you having me as a guest on your podcast. But I am in a situation right now where I have my grandson across the street, and I should probably attend to him.
Okay. Yeah. No problem. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to give you some shout outs before you go. Could you tell everybody what your website is again? I'm so sorry.
My newest film, feature film, is called Quiet Voices in a Noisy World.
Okay.
The Struggle for Change in Jasper, Texas. It's premiering as part of a retrospective of my films at Cinema Village in New York City, November 14th to 20th.
Okay.
I also urge listeners to look on my website, documentaryarts.org, to find out more about our films.
Yes.
I have more than 24 films on Amazon Prime. I've published over 40 books. And my newest novel, Come Round Right, is a book I think everyone should read.
Yes.
So I so appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no problem, sir.
And let me know when this is posted, and please stay in touch.
Oh, yeah. Well, please come back anytime you want to, okay?
All right. Well, you take care of yourself, and I wish you the very best.
Thank you so much, sir. That means a lot. All right. Thank you. Okay. Bye.